the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Lifetime Income. Today's program is a continuation of a previous program, Elder Abuse, Don't Let It Happen to You. Rejoining me on the show today is Carolyn Rosenblatt. She's a registered nurse. She's also a legal consultant, a lawyer with a litigation background. She also does a lot of mediation, and she also is the author of the book, The Family Guide to Aging Parents, and the same website. Carolyn, welcome back to the program. I'd like to pick up from the last program that we had, and I had asked you at that time, why is it that women who tend to be the survivors in most cases, at least for Social Security survivorship, 85% are women, they tend to name siblings, friends, and family members as sort of their successor trustees and to handle their estate? Why do they do that? Because it often doesn't work out well.
Hi, you're welcome, Jim. Yes, I think you're right that it is a problem because the elder who has maybe anticipated losing a spouse or has lost a spouse is feeling vulnerable. And they want to be able to turn to someone they believe they can trust. The problem is they're not getting enough guidance in figuring out who really is trustworthy. Or perhaps whoever is preparing their legal documents isn't asking enough questions. And I blame that on the lawyers. For one thing, you don't want to name somebody who's the same age you are. Because if you're daft, they may be, you know, losing their marbles at the same time. That's not going to work out too well. But they pick people who are not necessarily qualified. They pick people whom they like. And that should not be the criterion.
As you mentioned, they feel comfortable with friends, family members. And Carolyn, isn't most of the abuse cases, at least in my own practice, I've come across most of the abuse cases have occurred with family members where you would think it would be from some institution or somebody else, but it ends up being family. Why is that, do you think?
Because family can easily manipulate the elder on the basis of their relationship. Sometimes they do it sneakily, by insinuating that the other people who might be interested in whatever the money or assets are evil or they're going to take advantage of them. And sometimes they do it by threats and intimidation and coercion and fraud and all kinds of things. But it is true that family members, because of the opportunity to steal, are the most frequent financial abusers of elders. And the second most frequent are caregivers or people known to the elder through relationships. So it's scary because the people they're supposed to be able to trust are the ones that sometimes turn out cannot be trusted and should never have been in that position of power.
I want to bring up another issue that often happens, and I actually intervened in a case with this, where it was a surviving spouse. She was lonely. She met somebody at a church bingo game, and he was trying to talk her into putting her money with his money in a joint bank account because they would get a better rate on a jumbo CD.
Oh, gosh.
And, oh, yes, I know. And a lot of times a sole survivor may commingle funds or get scammed. I actually ran across two or three cases like this. Mm-hmm. And I want to come back to something. We talked about this last time. There was a special report on one of the cable stations the other night about this increase of elder abuse with older seniors with these phone calls. We mentioned it last time. They call, you know, your grandson is in jail. He needs money. Or I'm the IRS, we need your tax or bank account number, or we're going to confiscate. Why is this so prevalent, and what can be done to protect against it, other than you never disclose any information to anybody on the phone?
Right, and that's what we always try to tell elders, and they somehow think it's not going to happen to them, or they forget. It's common because it works. As someone who was jailed for doing this kind of scamming said, it's a lot easier than robbing a bank. They have a list of phone numbers. The perpetrator keeps calling until they find a sucker. They catch that person off guard. That person may be isolated, maybe they're lonely, or maybe they just think they're smarter than everybody else and they're going to get this great deal. Whatever their motivation is, the perpetrator of this crime, and it is a crime in the state of California, is able to finagle, manipulate, and get them to do something that they would not normally do. And part of the reason for that is that our older generation is really the handshake generation. There was more trust. If you asked a 25-year-old to give you money, they'd probably say, go take a flying leap. But an older person may be caught off guard because they're more accustomed to trusting. They're less cynical. They're less suspicious than we would hope they would be in the face of that kind of approach on the phone. Part of it also is that we marginalize elders in this country. We do not give them as much attention, honor, and respect as they should have. So feeling lonely or isolated makes them even more vulnerable. And this is particularly true after the loss of a spouse. You start out by mentioning widows, newly widowed people. It's a huge red flag. There are all kinds of things that happen during that vulnerable post-death grieving process when the person is really not very good at making decisions. It's their vulnerability that really, I think, is key to why the thieves keep doing this so much.
And also, Carolyn, don't you run into this situation where, let's say, somebody has the beginning signs of dementia, but it hasn't been picked up yet by either family members, or maybe they haven't been to their doctor recently?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And there's competent research from the University of Alabama at Birmingham by some very competent people, one a neuropsychologist and a lawyer, who has measured the concept of financial capacity. And he's defined it. It's really, really good. And that is the ability to manage your money in a way that is in your best self-interest. Okay, so at the earliest stages of Alzheimer's disease and probably other dementias too, you've lost your complete financial decision-making capacity. It's going away. It is affected at a moderate degree in the earliest stages of Alzheimer's. By the time someone reaches the so-called middle stages of Alzheimer's disease or other dementia, they are severely impaired for making financial decisions. So it's true. At the early stages, maybe they can still take care of themselves, maybe drive a car still. They can bathe and feed and dress and take care of their needs. But if you ask them to keep track of their bills, they might not be able to do that. They might not be able to smell a scam when it hits them, whereas a younger person who's not impaired at all is going to see that right away. That sounds fishy. That "it sounds fishy" part of the brain doesn't work anymore, even in the earliest stages of dementia.
You know, one of the things we as advisors find ourselves on the front lines of elder abuse because we detect it, we pick it up. All of a sudden, we know that mom's got dementia, dad's got dementia, and they've appointed junior or a daughter to take over. And all of a sudden, there's large distributions being made. There's money being withdrawn from the account. We were in a situation recently called in where basically two siblings changed the life insurance beneficiaries to themselves and then went down to an attorney who was not fully, this is in the early signs of dementia. They were working on mom and tried to alter the estate plan in favor of themselves to the detriment of their other siblings. Could you address the fact that advisors are really there on the front lines because they see this when it happens?
Absolutely, Jim. And when my husband, who is a geriatric psychologist, and I realized that financial professionals are on the front line and that you don't get any training in aging issues in your education, we started another website called aginginvestor.com. And our material there, which includes online courses and two books and lots of free downloadable checklists, helps financial advisors deal with being on the front line, recognizing, for example, the signs of diminished capacity, the red flags. We have a 10 red flags checklist, which is free. We have the 7 warning signs of financial elder abuse as a checklist, downloadable and free. And those things can help guide the advisor who isn't maybe quite as sophisticated as you are, Jim, to see what's going on and to take steps. You're allowed to hold transactions. You are allowed to hold transactions. If you think those withdrawals are getting suspicious or don't look right, you can put the brakes on those. But then something has to happen. And sometimes the perpetrator is the person that was appointed to the power of attorney position. So you're in a catch-22. But I think referring these cases where there is suspected abuse to competent civil attorneys who handle elder abuse is an option.
Yeah, some of the times when a client is reluctant to name, let's say, a corporate trustee as a backup, Carolyn, we will ask, are there other family members that we can contact should something happen to your appointee or we need to consult with another family member? Because, you know, if we see this, who do we call? And so it puts us in a difficult situation. Let's talk about, Carolyn, ways legally that our listeners could avoid having something like this happen to them or maybe a loved one, a parent. What can they do legally to prevent this from happening?
One of the first things is to make sure that as the parents get past retirement age, after 65 or whatever time they retire, that they update the estate plan. Things change. The favored son or daughter, whoever it was that was appointed 20 years ago, maybe they got a drug problem now, or maybe they've lost their jobs and are greedy. Who knows? But I think one needs to look at not only the structure of the estate plan, because the laws have changed a lot with trusts in the last 15 years. Those need to be updated, and the appointed people need to be looked at again to be sure that they still are the right ones. One needs to look very closely at whether they have any motivation to do the wrong thing. And I think it's really important to have backup plans. For example, if the trust seems to be potentially at risk because there's only one trustworthy person around and who knows what's going to happen to them 10 years from now, one can appoint a trust protector to whom the trustee, the successor for mom or dad, is accountable, so that they don't run amok and create more legal problems. It's also really important to have family conversations about what is going to happen if either elder in the family loses the ability to be independent. And I think having those conversations is a critical way to avoid conflicts, because there's nothing worse than a family fight about money. They go on for years. I sometimes volunteer at the court and help settle the judges working on a case or it's going to trial. And they have lawyers who volunteer to help settle these cases at the last before trial. One need not spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to get to that point where you have somebody help you. There is mediation. Mediation is a process by which agreements can be made voluntarily. And since I'm a mediator, I'm a very strong proponent of using family mediation to help obviate some of these risks that exist when we have an elder who's losing his marbles or her marbles and they need to make decisions and they're not very good at it anymore.
What about the idea that, let's say, a mom is the survivor, she wants to name Junior as, let's say, successor trustee or with medical powers, but also suggesting maybe a backup trustee? Junior may sound like, yeah, I want to do this for mom, but also when it actually takes place, he may not have the expertise, the time, or for example, Junior may, you know, mom's in California, Junior is in Florida.
Yeah, that's very common because families are scattered now. You know, traditionally in this country, the elders lived with their offspring and their grandchildren until they died. But we've got people all over the place. I have a case right now with three different adult children living in three different states, and mom was living somewhere else. And they got into a big fight after dad died. So it's very problematic. I think that's one of the things when one is reviewing or updating a person's estate plan. And, you know, this can be done in like an hour or two. It's not some huge expense. But to look at what's practical, especially when you're talking about a power of attorney and a healthcare directive. We call a healthcare directive a living will sometimes, but it's basically what do you want toward the end of your life about treatment? Who's in charge of making those decisions if you can't? If they're in Florida and you're here, the person who's appointed, they're not close enough to do any good. So it's time to revise those documents and update them, which can be done without a lawyer. You know, you can draft a new healthcare directive or a new power of attorney without a lawyer. But, you know, it's best to get them checked out to make sure they're correct. And that's where the lawyers come in. But everybody needs to look at that when there's separation of family members from the elder and the family members have authority for decision making over either money or health.
Yeah, and how do you prevent a situation? We ran into a case where it was clear that mom with dementia needed to be in assisted care, but the trustees, in this case, it was her son and a daughter, did not want to spend the money for the care when it was obvious mom needed it, because obviously that would be drawn down principal, which they were hoping to inherit. How do you get around something like that?
It's very difficult because they're in charge of the money. And what's really sad is that they are depriving the elder of the elder's own assets now needed to support a dignified life because of their greed. They think it's their money before the parent has died. It's not. I call it vulture syndrome. You know, vulture syndrome, they're circling around waiting for the elder to die so they can get the cash, you know. I think one of the things that can happen is that an outside party should be contacted. Sometimes that's Adult Protective Services. If mom has dementia and is found wandering on the street or can't take care of herself, she can't remember how to take a shower, she's not eating properly because she can't remember how to do the grocery shopping, and no one wants to pay for it, sometimes those call for a conservatorship over the two not very nice kids who are depriving their mother of her basic needs. But it has to be a very extreme case before Adult Protective Services is going to refer it for investigation, and the county council would apply for a conservatorship over those problems and appoint somebody outside and neutral. One other way around it is to agree among everybody else on a neutral person, which we call a fiduciary. Not fiduciary meaning like you, Jim, having a good responsibility for your clients to put their interests first. A fiduciary is a licensed person in the state of California who can handle the money. And they, as neutral, can order a care manager, for example, to come in and say, here's what your parent needs. This is our recommendation. And that can be used by a neutral person to actually decide to pay for that.
Yeah, the way we found out, Carolyn, in this case, one of the neighbors called us because that was the case. Mom was found wandering around. She wasn't taking her meds. And in this case, we told the kids they needed to get this done. And basically, we had to come to a point where the neighbor would testify and we were going to call Adult Protective Services because it was obvious something needed to be done. I want to talk about another issue that we've heard about these stories. Mom or dad is the lone survivor. They've got a lot of money, mega bucks. They're lonely. You know, maybe dad is 85 and all of a sudden he's dating a 40-year-old. They want to get married. How do you protect, you know, he's got his senses, but he's lonely. How do you protect dad or even mom from somebody that, you know, we call them gold diggers that are coming in there and they're figuring, God, dad's 85. He'll be gone in a couple of years and I'll get the money.
Oh, sure. And I've actually seen cases like that where it was perfectly legal to do it because the elder was okay in his or her senses and had their, what we call their testamentary capacity, that is the ability to make a will or a trust. And that's a pretty low bar to meet in California. You don't have to know very much to be able to change your estate documents. When there are no adult children, these people are suckers, these older people who are lonely and isolated and vulnerable, you know, that money's going to get taken by the so-called boyfriend or girlfriend or whoever. If there are adult children, it is very important to keep close tabs on dad in the case you're using, close tabs on his mental status, go with him to the doctor. Don't ignore warning signs like he forgot how to find his way home or he can't remember that he talked to you yesterday. Those are not normal changes of aging. Those are warning signs of dementia, possibly. There could be other causes, but those are common warning signs. If the children are aware of these things, they need to have a frank conversation with the boyfriend or girlfriend. And sometimes just shining a spotlight on what's going on is enough to put a stop to any conniving or abuse or manipulation. We're watching. Dad left his money to us in his estate plan. We want to make sure that you're aware that we are paying attention. We know that dad has XYZ medical condition right now and that he's vulnerable. And we are paying very close attention to the way things are going so that nothing changes from his original intention of how he wanted his estate to go.
You know, I can't emphasize this. My best friend's father lost his wife, lonely, married a woman off a website, was liquidating all his real estate holdings, and had the beginning signs of dementia. And he was a practicing attorney, very successful one. Long story short, Carolyn, she took half the money when he sold the properties, and she sent it outside the country. So this happens over and over again. So if we were to boil this down, if you were to have your checklist, let's tell our listeners some of the things that should be done or should be thought of right now so no one finds themselves in this kind of situation.
Let me preface this by saying you can't always control what someone does with an estate plan if they are, in quotes, in love. If they have their right mind still, they have the right to cut out everybody and give their money to a gold digger. I mean, there are people who leave their money to a cat. So, you know, we allow weird things in our society on the belief that a person is competent until proven otherwise. Okay, so that's sort of how the law generally sees these things. But I think the closeness of relationships with adult children and other loved ones is the key to making sure that nobody gets screwed over, so to speak. If you show attention and love to the elder, they are going to remember that. Everybody needs attention. We're human beings born into a kind of a society that doesn't necessarily do that for older people. You know, the kids move away, the elder is alone, somebody sees the opportunity, then they get greedy and start figuring out how they're going to grab the assets from that elder before or after they die. It's not uncommon, but I think it is the closeness of relationships with people who are the offspring or siblings of this vulnerable human being that are really going to be the most protective thing that we can do is to maintain those relationships, stay in very frequent contact, show up. Don't be lazy about that. It's for their protection. And if you're a potential heir, it's for your protection too.
And Carolyn, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your book, The Family Guide to Aging Parents, how they can find out more about it, or the services that your firm provides?
Thank you very much for asking that, Jim. As a lawyer, my litigation career taught me some very important things, one of which is, let's see if we can keep people out of the courtroom. It's a horrible waste of energy and time for a lot of people, and it's not very satisfying for most people, no matter if you so-called win or if you lose. So I think communication is critical. And if people don't get along and they don't know how to reach agreements, then that's what mediation is about. So that's one of the services we offer. And when I say we, my husband and business partner is a geriatric psychologist. He's been working with families for 45 years. He's really good at resolving conflicts and helping calm things down and teaching people what to say so they don't infuriate each other even more. So we have that added benefit. So mediation is a service, but sometimes people are just lost. They don't know what to do. When you mention these cases you've run into, Jim, I've seen them too, you know, where the siblings are fighting over one sibling who absconded with mom, took over control of her house, took her to a lawyer, unscrupulous lawyer, changed the estate plan. Now all the benefits of everything that she's got with her millions or whatever it is going to this one person instead of divided equally as she intended. They don't know quite what to do with that. So we have these folks as clients. The communication can be purely by phone if they're scattered all over, or they come in if they're local in Northern California. And we sit down with them and help them plan out a strategy. How are we going to deal with this? Should this case be mediated? Do you need to go after this person for a criminal offense, elder abuse? We have good statutes in California. A lot of people don't know what they are or what they mean. So I help them with that to understand what the law does and doesn't do. We look at other lawyers' drafts of people's estate plan and who they've appointed and what it takes to get somebody off the trust if they're no longer capable with dementia or whatever. So it's interpreting those things and giving instruction and help to people who want those questions answered. We offer the book, The Family Guide to Aging Parents. My intention in writing it was so that people could get information without having to go pay a lawyer just to find out some of the basics. There's a chapter on how to have the money conversation with your aging parent. There's one on how to hire a home care worker safely, because remember, a lot of them end up abusing their patient, their client. There's a chapter on how you deal with driving when they shouldn't be driving, how to get the keys away, so to speak. There's a chapter on what's assisted living, what are the pros and cons, what's skilled nursing. If you have to put somebody in that kind of a place, a nursing home, how do you do that and keep them safe there? Because it's very risky. We have, you know, information about what it costs and how you deal with taking care of someone at home. So it's pretty comprehensive based on a lot of experience. There are a lot of case illustrations in there about real folks. But that's basically a summary of what we do. We mediate, we consult, we offer information, some of it free. I have actually 4 books. One is for lawyers and business professionals. 2 are for financial folks like you, Jim. And they help people with the planning process and understanding what's involved.
Well, listen, Carolyn, I want to thank you for coming back for the second part of this series. Unfortunately, it's becoming more common, much more common than we think. In many cases, go unreported. So I want to thank you for coming back and sharing your wisdom with our listeners.
Thank you for being an excellent interviewer, Jim. I appreciate the time and hope that if one person is helped by our conversation, we have succeeded today.
All right. All the best, Carolyn. Thanks, and come back again.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.